Thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion at the Sydney Institute on Jewish Settlement in Australia. Dr. Damien Freeman makes a welcome return. He's spoken here previously, most recently on his book on the Abbott government. But tonight, on the occasion, talking about, related to the publication of his book, The Aunt's Mirrors, a Memoir. And Susan Rutland makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. Now, I should say that Damien Freeman is a fellow at the P.M. Glynn Institute and author, of course, of The Aunt's Mirrors. And Emeritus Professor Susan Rutland is Emeritus Professor at Sydney University in the Department of Hebrew, Biblical and Jewish Studies. And recently, a couple of years ago, was the co-winner of the Prime Minister's Literary Prize for History for the book she authored with Sam Lipsky called Let My People Go. So tonight we're going to start off with Dr. Freeman talking for about 15 minutes, and then we'll follow with Professor Rutland talking for the same length, and then we'll come to question and discussion, and away we go. Many thanks, Damien.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's good to be back at the Sydney Institute. I was here a couple of weeks ago with Dr. Jesse Norman MP, a British minister who I brought out from England and who was talking about his book on Edmund Burke. And we'd had a busy few days with him in Sydney and ended up here and went out for dinner afterwards at the Union Club. And as I was walking up the staircase with Gerard Henderson, he said to me, of course, in the good old days when Jews and Catholics weren't allowed in the Union Club, you and I could have had an early night. And the thought came back to me when I was thinking about Anne's invitation to speak here, because the book that I'm talking about, The Aunt's Mirrors, was in fact launched at the Union Club. And at the end of that launch, the great thespian Terry Clark remarked to me that once upon a time, you know, it would have been unimaginable that a memoir about a Jewish family would be launched at the Union Club, let alone be launched by an Aborigine. Because Noel Pearson kindly agreed to launch that book, and that was kind of a thank you to me for my work with respect to constitutional recognition of the Indigenous people, which I've been helping him with. And I'd become interested in that work largely through my work writing about Roddy Marr, which I've spoken about here the first time I came, and then, of course, by Tony Abbott, who was very committed to this. And that those were really the two things that got me interested in thinking about constitutional recognition. And I mention that because it's perhaps not surprising that it was the ruminations of these Catholics on Indigenous dispossession and discrimination that should resonate with the Jew. And as you will all know, there's been no shortage of Jewish lawyers who've been busying themselves with Aboriginal land rights and constitutional recognition. But I mention this connection because Dyson Hayden quoted from Ludwig Windhorst in the inaugural PM Glynn lecture on religion, law and public life that we organised at the Institute, and it was a quote that was repeated only a couple of weeks ago by Jesse Norman in his second PM Glynn lecture when he said, "Anti-Catholicism is the anti-Semitism of the intellectuals." And it's worth thinking about that thought. There's much, of course, that's good about the world that we live in, but not everything gets better. Anti-Semitism still colours much of how Jews respond to the world that they find themselves in. It is indeed endemic to their story. And it connects them in one way with the plight of the Aborigines in this country and in another way with Catholics. But it's also a curious fact that anti-Semitism doesn't feature very much at all in the story that unfolds in The Aunt's Mirrors. The Aunt's Mirrors is what I call a family memoir. I gave it the subtitle Family Experience and Meaningfulness. The book has its origin when I was house-sitting for my aunt, and she was showing me around when I arrived, and she pointed out at the top of her wardrobe was a collection of family history material that she and my great aunt had collated over the years. Well, I'd written a book about Roddy Marr, and when I was looking through this material, it occurred to me that my own family had a story that was worth telling. I told the story of other people's family, why not my own? So I set about doing this, and at the time when I was living in my aunt's house in Cammeray, which is a workman's cottage that has been renovated in a somewhat idiosyncratic way. And a real feature of this is the eclectic collection of mirrors. Each of the small rooms is dominated by a mirror. And so I started thinking about this, how I was going to do this, and I settled on a device in which each of the chapters is named after one of the mirrors in the house and begins with a description of the mirror. And in one way or another, this leads into the discussion of one of the branches of my maternal family and the connections that I see between the family and the objects in the house. So most of this family made their way to Australia in the 19th century, mostly from part of what is now Poland and what was then under the domination of Russia. And they were Jews who came to Australia and who remained committed to the faith of their fathers for six generations in Australia. And as I say, my book is a memoir, it's not a history. I'm very conscious that I was not engaged in the activity of the history. That was it was my aunt and my great aunt who were the family historians. I was really just reflecting on their activities. And I was interested in what it was about the lives they were researching that was so meaningful. And more than that, I was interested in why they even thought that researching these lives was a meaningful thing to do. And what struck me in all of this was at the core of it all is a commitment to a shared form of life. And that's what I want to try and say something about today, this shared form of life. Paul Kelly recently wrote in The Australian that selfism has taken over Australia. By that he doesn't mean necessarily being selfish, perhaps to be self-absorbed, which can of course lead to being selfish, but more importantly it's the idea that people are becoming convinced that what makes their lives meaningful is to be found within themselves. This book is about an earlier Australia, and it's about a world in which the meaningfulness of people's lives came from being part of a shared form of life. And for most people, that shared form of life was family life. It's an idea that I think is perhaps captured by the German word Geist, which means the spirit that people can participate in and which manifests itself through the institutions of a tradition. Well, as you know, I wrote this book some time ago now, and last year my publisher sent me a box of remaindered books. And when I started work at Australian Catholic University in the public policy think tank, it was Christmas time, and I thought to myself, in the fashion that perhaps my family would appreciate, why waste good money on Christmas cards when you've got remaindered books? So I sent out copies of the book in lieu of Christmas cards, one of which went to Anne and Jared. And Anne was kind enough to write back and commented on it. And so I thought tonight I'd say something about four observations that she made about the book. The things that attracted her attention was the way this is a story that is built up from fragments, what it has to say about the Jewish contribution to Australia, and something about a comparison with the much more famous book by Edmund de Waal called The Hare with Amber Eyes, which was in some sense an inspiration for me, and finally something about the entrepreneurial spirit of the family. So Anne said to me, I was engrossed at your managing to bring to life such a family and its story from the fragments you had. And I think that's a fair enough observation, because I think my aunt herself would have been surprised when she came back from her holiday to see the first draft of the manuscript and how this had come together. And It is a matter of preserving fragments. Our family was never one to boast about its forebears, and I wouldn't suggest that there's any grand narrative in this book. What there is an expression of value, and it's about the fragments that I found that were witness to the values of ordinary people, the scraps of memory that they thought were important to remember, the bits and pieces that they couldn't bear to part with. And that is very much the way this whole book is structured, not to try and give you a narrative, but to paint a picture of what it was that mattered to these people through the bits and pieces that are left. I think she's right to say that it has something to tell us about the Jewish contribution to Australia. The Jews have, of course, given Australia Sir Isaac Isaacs and Sir John Monash. We're yet to give Australia a Prime Minister, but I fondly turned my mind to the member for Barara, and hope springs eternal. But my family's contribution is by no means of that order. These are just ordinary people. As Anne says, the Jewish contribution, the Jewish-European contribution to Australian genes is a marvel. And I think she's right, but the marvel in the case of these people is a contribution that they made to society without undermining the shared Jewish experience that they brought with them. They were well known and respected within their local communities despite their difference. And that's something important to remember, because this is about a time which was much more sectarian and when there was little in the way of appreciation of difference. So I think that it does tell you something about the Australian contribution, albeit not something of the grandees of Australian Jewry. The epigraph to the book is taken from The Hare with Amber Eyes by Edmund de Waal. And in particular, I quote, objects have always been carried, sold, bartered, stolen, retrieved, and lost. People have always given gifts. It's how you tell their stories that matters. And I was very much inspired by the way de Waal tells the stories of the objects in his book. He's a potter, and he's particularly good at describing the tactile properties of the objects that he's engaging with. There is, however, a real difference between the way he talks about objects and the way I do. He's very much interested in the personal significance of objects, what it is that's meaningful for an individual about a particular object. In my book, it's quite different, because what I've tried to capture is not a sense of the meaning for an individual, but the sense of shared meaning that matters to a family, and that the sense in which these objects are an expression of shared values. There's another sense, I think, that's an important difference. De Waal makes much of his family's connection with Proust, and I can't blame him. I probably would too if that were my lot. But as my publisher, Veronica Sumegi, said, comparing the prospects of my book with his, we can't pretend that 19th century Grafton is turn of the century Vienna. And that's true. This is a book about out-of-the-way places that didn't have any really significant impact on the course of human history. But as Anne was kind enough to say of my memoir, it reminded her in an Australian way of memoirs like The Hare with Amber Eyes, albeit without the grand connections, which, of course, is the Australian part. She's right. The whole point of this book is that it's about ordinary people and the meaningfulness of ordinary lives. And if doing that makes it all the more Australian, then I'm glad about that. The final thing I want to say is something that she picked up, that the people in this book are all preoccupied with small business. They all run their own businesses. They're dealers in jewels, in curios, in schmutters, and cardboard boxes. They were tailors, but never professionals. They had little formal education. Indeed, my mother was the first in her family to get a university degree. My grandfather was really only a rag and bone man after the Second World War, who collected used cardboard boxes for resale, but went on to run a plant manufacturing corrugated cardboard and employing over 100 people. And this was an achievement, but it's an achievement very much within the spirit of his family. as Anne says, they believed that to make a living, one must create a business of some sort. No public payroll mentality there. And that's something I think I too would be proud to see in these people. So look, that's really just an attempt to say something briefly about the book and the way I've tried to capture the geist of these people. I look forward to hearing what Professor Rutland has to tell us about the history of Jews in Australia, both in terms of their contribution to Australian society and in terms of the experience that Jews had in Australia. I've tried to capture something a bit different here. I've tried to capture the meaningfulness of the life of one Jewish family. It's a shared form of life, and it captures something of the entrepreneurial spirit, something of the way it finds expression in ordinary everyday objects, and most importantly, something about the fact that these people believed that there was a right way for them to live as a family. The former chief rabbi of the Commonwealth of Nations, Lord Saxe of Aldgate, paid a great compliment to Paul Johnson's History of the Jews when he said that no Gentile historian had ever understood the Jews as well as Johnson does in that book. And he writes there, "No people has ever insisted more firmly than the Jews that history has a purpose and humanity a destiny." Well, that inspires me, and I'm proud to think that I'm part of such a people. If I'm honest, I'll admit that my people have been plagued by selfism as much as anyone else in Australia. But the Arts Mirrors is a reminder that there is another way of living, and it's a way that flourished in Australia for well over a century, and we owe it a great debt because it was the spirit of the pioneer generations. In the book of Deuteronomy, Moses tells the children of Israel, "It's not in heaven that thou shouldst say, who will go up for us to heaven and bring it to us and make us hear it that we may do it? Neither is it beyond the sea that thou shouldst say, who shall go over the sea for us and bring it unto us and make us hear it that we may do it? But the word is very nigh unto thee, in thy mouth and in thy heart, that thou mayst do it." The people in this book are just ordinary Australians. They did not go up to heaven in a chariot of fire like Elijah. Nor do I believe that God revealed himself to them as he did to Elijah in what the King James Bible so beautifully calls the still small voice. They came from beyond the sea and they brought something precious with them. And I hope that my memoir might enable us to hear it, a still small voice of its own kind. They understood the meaningfulness of our individual lives and that it comes from living together through hard work that enables us to support one another and through the shared values that imbue individual lives with shared meaning. The selfism that Paul Kelly so eloquently spoke of elsewhere is a real threat to the fabric of Australia. But if we were to return to our forebears, we might find that in their mouths and hearts lies a way of life that has enabled people to flourish together in Australia, and which might enable us to do so again.
To Susan Rutland's coming up, I should say that Susan is the author of Edge of the Disparo, which is been out in a number of editions, and so tonight she's going to talk for us on the general topic. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming. I hope everyone can hear me okay, because I have a soft voice. Damien's book, and indeed the anecdotes which we've heard this evening of Australian discrimination against Jews, Catholics, and that's not to talk about our Indigenous Australians who have suffered the most, is part of the millennia-old story of the Jewish diaspora. The word diaspora means dispersion. It's a Greek word. And Jews have been dispersed across the globe, both voluntarily through creating trading networks and involuntarily through persecution and expulsions. The words internationalism, globalization, transnationalism, they're all the vogue today. But they were well known to the Jewish community centuries before they became the vogue. In writing about the Jewish diaspora, I've argued that there have been three major Jewish diasporas. The first was in Babylonia, the Mizrahim. The second in Spain, the Sfaradim. And the third and last was in Eastern Europe, centered in Poland, the Ashkenazim, which ended in 1942 with the fires of Auschwitz. Today's Jewish world is concentrated in Israel and the United States. There are hardly any Jews left in those first three great Jewish diasporas. Indeed, if we talk about Baghdad, once one-third Jewish, today there are 9 or 8 very elderly Jews left. So, Damien's memoir is focused mainly on the exodus of the third diaspora from Poland. But one branch seems to have stemmed from the conversos, the forced converts among Sephardi Jews who continued to secretly practice their Judaism, particularly in Portugal. Some of these crypto-Jews escaped from Portugal to England, and by the 1590s, there was a substantial group of crypto-Jews living in London. Damien's story draws on that. However, for the Western free world, as Damien's memoir highlights, it was the East European Jewish exodus that was the most impactful. Jews suffered from the partition of Poland from the late 18th century onwards. Then, in 1881, Tsar Alexander II was assassinated by a group of 5 radical students, one of whom was Jewish. His successor, Alexander III, exploited the tradition of the Jewish scapegoat and led to pogroms and terrible persecution of the Jews. After 1881, those who could escape from Tsarist Russia did. Indeed, over 2 million migrated to the United States. The British Jewish population increased fourfold from 46,000 to 180,000 until in 1905 the Aliens Act stopped the flow. By the way, in the United States it was 1924 that the flow was stopped due to prejudice and discrimination. And similarly, in South Africa, 40,000, what was known as the Litvaks, the Jews from the Baltic region, but also Canada, substantial numbers, but much fewer came to Australia because in that period we were just too far. It was much easier to get on a sailing boat, on a steamship, in Hamburg and go to Ellis Island than it was to possibly still be faced with a sailing boat or the long haul with a steamship to Australia. However, in my book, Edge of the Diaspora, which you've just seen, I quote from the experience of one of these Jewish victims, John Sackville, that illustrate the brutality he had experienced during one pogrom attack in his village near Bialystok in Russian Poland, as described by his son. "They breathed down my neck," my father said. "I was just a boy, you know, but to them I was a little Jew, and they let me have it. They kicked me and thrashed me with leather thongs fixed to a heavy piece of lead." And he should know, John's son wrote, "for by dodging the blows, he felt the lead part penetrating his back." His father took him to the Bialystok hospital where they removed it. To this day, John carries the scar of his encounters with the Cossacks. End of quote. John Sackville, of course, became a leading retailer in Melbourne, and his family have continued to make significant contributions to Australian life, both within the general and the Jewish communities, with Justice Ronald Sackville in Sydney being part of that tradition. In some cases, the migration of family members from Eastern Europe started earlier than the 1880s, due both to seeking a better financial future and to avoiding persecution. Stamen expresses it in relation to Polish Jewish migration, both during the Gold Rush era of the 1850s and 1860s and later, quote, "There was also a good livelihood to be made in servicing the needs of the gold diggers and more generally those who were cultivating the hinterland of the early colonial centres. It was a combination of these mercantile opportunities and political stability that attracted Jews." Damien asks, why was this migration different from all other migrations? I can't pretend that the departure of these families was a great loss to Poland or Polish Jewry, or their arrival a significant boon for Australia. Yet, for some of these Polish Jewish migrants who came in the same period, it was a boon for Australia. Easily the best known names, of course, and Damien's already mentioned them, are Sir John Monash and Sir Isaac Isaacs. Monash came from a Prussian Jewish family, part of Prussian Poland, but it was Poland, today in the area of Wrocław. And Sir Isaac's parents were also refugees from Poland, and he was to become the first governor-born general of Australia in 1930. So, as Damien writes, his family did not reach these august heights, but their stories tell the story of and shine a light onto the values and experiences of this wave of Jewish migrants from Eastern Europe. Many, as we heard a little bit, settled mainly in country areas, and in the second half of the 19th century, 40% of Jews lived in rural Australia, not in the main metropolitan cities of Sydney and Melbourne. With Damien's family, they spread from Grafton, as we've heard, to Beechworth in Victoria. Grafton had a small, active Jewish community, as described in the book, and at one stage planned to build its own synagogue. It didn't come about. But as with Damien's family, most of the Jews in the rural areas were not the farmers. They were not the gold diggers. But they started their lives as hawkers, became small shopkeepers in country towns, and often made substantial contributions to the development of local institutions, enjoying the freedom and equality that Australia had to offer. They wanted to give back to their new homeland. But for those who wished to keep a Jewish lifestyle, they moved back to either Sydney or Melbourne. Some, or others, intermarried and were lost to Judaism, a theme which Damien touches on when he writes about Esther Dora, his great-grandmother, who saved the family candlesticks, was the only thing she took with her when she was hiding during a pogrom in Poland. And later she brought these candlesticks with her to Australia. His grandmother, Joan, attached great significance to them. But Damien notes, and I quote, "It was a source of great sadness to her that although the candlesticks remained in the family, they were owned by descendants who had left the faith and were no longer made Shabbos on a Friday night." This was also true of many of the Jewish migrants of this period, when there was a high rate of assimilation through intermarriage, not just acculturation and integration, which all of them did. In some ways, I feel that Damien's memoir underestimates the importance of his own family's contributions. His great-grandfather, Joshua Brukas, contributed to the founding of Central Synagogue in 1912. As you know, Central today is the largest Jewish community in Sydney. And I have actually written in my various books, I've published a number of books, about three other members of Damien's family. For me, Abraham Marcus Lowenthal, known as AM, really stands out. He was an insurance broker who became president of what was then known as the Maccabean Hall in 1926. The hall was in severe financial difficulties. owing £12,000. Lowenthal managed to reduce that to £5,000, a significant achievement during his presidency. Today, of course, it is the Sydney Jewish Museum, the same building. In the triumph of the Jewish spirit about the history of the JCA, I've also written about Damien's grandfather, Noel Lasker, and his contributions to the founding of the JCA in 1967. Today, it is a financial mainstay of the Jewish community. And finally, I've referred to author and literary personality Enid Baumberg, who was one of the early writers, female writers, Jewish writers, in Sydney in the 1920s, before she married and moved to Cape Town. Their lives, and the lives of the Jewish family that Damien writes about in his memoir, when he writes about family and meaning, meaningfulness, to me reflect the saying of the great Jewish sage Hillel: "If I am not for myself, who am I? But if I am only for myself, what am I? And if not now, when?" And I agree with Damien. The problem today is that too many of the younger generations, maybe also to some extent my own generation, focus too much on the first part of Hillel's saying. So Damien writes about the importance of family in terms of providing meaning to life. And in this section, which is towards the end of the book, he movingly describes the role recipes play in the maintenance of family tradition. He writes, "It's a matter of participating in a form of life in which they participated and which was handed down to them by those who came to Australia from Poland and which they might hand down to their children and grandchildren, not just as something they can eat, but as something that embodies a form of life that their family has held sacred." End of quote. My family also came from Poland. They were part of a later wave of migration that came before and after World War II. Damien's words ring so true for me in terms of my mother's recipes, particularly in this case for gefilte fish. And it's a big job to make it when Mum always made it. But for Passover and the Jewish New Year, I always make it. And this year, including, my daughter said, "Mum, can you please make gefilte fish for our Seder?" And I did. So reading the book gets you to reflect on your own family's trajectory and made me aware of the huge gaps in my own knowledge. My parents were the lucky ones. They came here in January 1939, and they belonged to what I've called, in Edge of the Diaspora, the watershed years, the period between and after World War II, when between 31 and 34 Jewish refugees and Holocaust survivors came to Australia and changed the numerical size of the community from 23,000 in 1933 to 59,000 in 1961. They transformed every aspect of Jewish life here. But I don't have any family mementos. All my four blood grandparents perished in the Shoah. The only grandparent who I know what happened to him during the Shoah is my grandparent Solomon or Shlomo Perlman, who was murdered in Plaszow. And I had two uncles who were saved by Oskar Schindler. The only memorabilia that I have are the photos that my mother put in the family album of her family, most of which have never been identified, and of my father's family in Poland, where luckily my uncle came later on and identified people for me, and also a member of the family who's actually written her memoir in relation to the Perlman-Weinfeld family. So Damien, you are lucky, because through the reflection of your Aunt Wiesel's mirror, you're able to document a key period of Jewish history, reflecting the impact of that wave of East European Jews, mainly from Poland, who escaped Europe in the late 19th and early 20th century, before the catastrophe, the Holocaust. Sadly, the undercurrent of Australian anti-Semitism, which you spoke about with the Union Club, and we can talk about the Melbourne Club, etc., etc., that undercurrent, which portrayed the Polish Jews as backward and undesirable migrants, prevented more Jews, including my own family, from arriving in this heaven called Australia in the late 1930s, and also limited the number of Jewish Holocaust survivors who came here after the war. But that is another story. Thank you.
And so we come to questions and discussion now. We've got, Anne's got, we've managed, the institute has managed to get some copies of the Aunt's Mirrors, a memoir by Damien Freeman, and some copies of Susan Rutland's Edge of the Diaspora, and they'll be selling after the event. And I'm sure the authors would like to, would be happy to sign copies. Now, can we get you both up here? Susan, I think you can stand on this side. Damien, if you come behind me and stand here. Remember to talk into the microphone. So now we come to question discussion, and we've got about we've got a bit over 20 minutes. So can I just start off getting a view from both of you, because we've been through the issue right this week of Sir John Monash, and people like Tim Fisher and others have spoken about how his career was blighted by anti-Semitism. But and there was anti-Semitism in Australia at the time, as you've both indicated. But I would have thought that for someone to become head of the Australian Army in the field of battle as a corps commander in 1918, who was knighted on the battlefront by the King and was a man of Jewish and Prussian background, that seemed to indicate to me that Australian society in the first two decades of the 20th century was pretty tolerant by the standards of the time of other Western nations. So let's hear from you, Damien, and let's hear from you, Susan, and then we'll go on to the discussion.
I think there's something to what you say, Jared. I think it probably was. And my understanding is there was a difference between the anti-Semitism, let's say, in Australia and in England, and that perhaps the attitude of the establishment in England had something to do with what happened at that point as to whether he became a field marshal. But yeah, look, I think you're right that it shows that in Australia, whatever attitudes might have been, it was a place that people could get on, that ability could get you a very long way, and I think that's a significant thing.
Susan?
Yes, and I agree with that, but Monash, after the war, did write to a friend from St Kilda Hebrew congregation, "I knew that I should not muck up, because if I mucked up, our people will be blamed for it." So Monash was not a religious Jew at all. And he was also a womanizer, and there are other things to his personality. But he was very aware of his Jewish heritage, and he was very aware that that in some ways that put an extra burden on him as a Jew. And yes, I do agree. I think what I talk about is a gentleman's anti-Semitism. It was an undercurrent. It was very much part of the, as I said, the Melbourne class, the upper class establishment, which we definitely saw with Charles Bean, the historian of World War I, and with Murdoch. So it's always a complex story. It's never black and white.
Let me just add one thing on that question about the undercurrent of establishment anti-Semitism, because I think one anecdote I can say, when I was in Cambridge, I had dinner with a very eminent elderly professor of history who was Jewish, and who said to me, oh, you know you'll never be, and we're talking about the colleges, the Oxbridge colleges, and he said to me, you know you'll never really be accepted here. And that was only a few years ago, and that was obviously based on his own experience. He'd come from America to England, I suppose 50 years ago. But it does say something about that. That's how, that was his experience of Oxbridge, was that was, and that he said it's the undercurrent, and he felt that it really was still a live thing.
But on the Field Marshal issue, the reason why Sir John Monash was never made a Field Marshal, because he never was a Field Marshal. He was an Army Corps commander, and on the Western Front in 1918, there were 19 Army Corps commanders from Britain, France, Canada, New Zealand. I mean, there were many corps. So the reason why he just wasn't a field marshal, and he wasn't in the strategy. He was a corps commander commanding a corps, an army fighting corps, but he wasn't running the strategy. That was being run by General Haig, who was a field marshal. Hang on. Yes, Anne.
Something else in that news too. I mean, when you describe what happens at Oxbridge, I mean, that happens to other groups in English society. Britain has its own class divisions, and it's a rigidity at the top. But in Australia, it is remarkable that our first Australian-born Governor General was Jewish background, and our great commander in the First World War was Jewish background. So it does say something about the practical, pragmatic side of Australia. And did that suit the kinds of, what I pointed out, the entrepreneurial spirit? And that dedication to profession, whatever it might be, is that an important part of what I see as the good that was given to the genes of Australians. I mean, there is a contribution there, and I wanted to flesh that out.
Anne, I agree, and I'm a historian that teaches abroad, and through my role at University of Sydney, I taught Jewish civilization. So looking at the development of Jewish civilization from the end of the formal biblical period through to the present day. And the thing which is so amazing is the role Jews throughout the ages have played in terms of entrepreneurial spirit. From the 9th century, Jews were trading from France to China. Numeracy, literacy, they were the doctors both in the Christian world and the Muslim world, to the key leadership, etc., etc. And so, I don't know about genes, but what it seems to me is that in some ways the persecution and the suffering forced Jews to strive harder, to do better, and when they were accepted, and it's something I grew up so strongly with from my late parents, that they were able to get here in January 39, is that the gratefulness where you had in some equality, it was not a perfect equality, but wherever you were accepted, to try and strive for that place where you were accepted. And it is an ongoing story. So there's no doubt that Jews have benefited greatly from the freedoms which Australia has offered. And equally, I think Australia has also benefited from the huge contribution, out of all proportion, to the tiny numbers. But they were tiny in Weimar Germany. Jews are 0.4% population here, but in Germany in the 1920s, they were 0.8%. So this is an ongoing story.
There's a question here.
Adrian, perhaps from the Pierre and Glynn Institute at ACU. I was wondering whether you think there is a connection between some of the sectarianism that was much stronger in the late 19th century and the early 20th century in Australia, and anti-Semitism. I mean, is there something about certain strands in Protestantism that you think might have spread that? And as the sectarianism abates, maybe anti-Semitism also returns and subsides.
Definitely the sectarianism against Jews and Catholics, and it's very interesting how the parallels, because indeed Jews and Catholics often supported each other, because Catholics were a lot more numerous. So, for example, golf courses. Jews and Catholics were excluded from most Protestant golf courses in this, you know, late 19th century into the 20th century. And we, Professor Colin Tatz, who of course is one of the experts on genocide, discrimination, etc., but he's written a history of the Monash golf course in the North Shore, which was created by Jews because they weren't allowed into other, and it was an open golf course. Anyone from any religion. Catholics had to do the same. Hospitals, St. Vincent's Hospital. Jews, until quite recently, even in, I know in my brother's time, and he's 10 years older than me, so we're talking about the 1950s, Royal Prince Alfred was a very Protestant institution. And you had a much, as a Jew, you had a much better chance at St. Vincent's, which of course was created by Catholics because of the same issues. So the sectarian, there was coming together of Jews and Catholics on that basis. In terms of anti-Jewish hatred, sadly it seems to morph. So it's not just sectarianism, and the anti-Jewish hatred of the present time is coming from different elements.
Damien, do you want to make a comment?
No.
So, Damien, tell us, why did you write the book? I mean, you're not really, you don't really write memoirs as a rule. Do you? Was there family pressure?
No, there certainly wasn't family pressure. Maybe the contrary, but no. Well, I'd written my book about Roddy Ma, and I'd edited another set of memoirs about a friend of mine. Who was part of the English establishment and who died. And so I suppose that was what, you know, made me think I should take some sort of interest in my own family's story. And I suppose I was interested in reflecting on these ideas that if you care to read the book, you see the last chapter has a rather different tone to the earlier chapters. The first chapters each talk about one of the branches of the family and what happened when they came to Australia and giving you some sort of history of that. The last is of a different nature. It's more sort of speculative and philosophical. When he launched it, Noel Pearson was kind enough to say that he thought the book was not one of history but of philosophy. Well, that flattered me a bit, but there was a sense in which I was interested in thinking about philosophical issues, which is what I've written about mostly as an academic philosopher, and thinking about how they played out in this family, and particularly thinking about some of the ideas of Roger Scruton in the context of doing that, and what he had to say about meaningfulness in the Church of England, partly, and more broadly, his thinking about how it is that value is created in the world, and what it is that makes lives meaningful, and the fact that this isn't just individual, it doesn't come just from individuals. That was what particularly interested me to try and capture in the book.
Thank you. With the current situation in Poland and the denial of anti-Semitism during the war, etc., etc., just wondering what your points of view on that are.
Actually, this is a topic that I've been very involved with. I'm on the Australian delegation for the International the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. And Australia's joined initially as an observer nation. Last November in Bern, we were just upgraded to being a liaison nation, and now our team is working very hard to become a member nation. And already in my second meeting in Romania, which was in a place today called Iași, known more by Jews as Iași, Professor Yehuda Bauer, Professor Emeritus, who is the key power in some ways, intellectual power, behind this organisation, spoke about his concerns with Poland. And it is very, very worrying because it means that you can't just write history honestly. you're always going to be worried. And even for myself, and I've published an article about March of the Living and the way the it's actually chapter more in a book than a journal article. The way the Melbourne Jewish survivors in 1998 strongly opposed the Australian Jewish community participating. So strongly indeed that the Jewish community didn't participate till 2001. And I quote these survivors, some of whom, like Jacob Rosenberg, have written their memoirs and received, I think he received the New South Wales Premier's Award for his memoir in Ghetto of Łódź. They're so critical of Poland. And I've quoted them. And that is not what the Polish government wants to hear. So I think it's very worrying in terms of intellectual honesty and freedom in this world. And well, we'll wait and see. I know that Yehuda Bauer and others, they went to Poland, they've had meetings, they have tried their hardest to get the government to change its mind, failing so. And just a little further anecdote, at the last our last meeting, was it the last, no, was it the, yeah, in Bern, just down in Switzerland. And it came up again in the workshop dealing with anti-Semitism and Holocaust denial. And there were two representatives from Poland, one from the main Institute of Historical Memory in Warsaw, whose English wasn't very good. So he read a prepared speech. And then there was a member from the Polish Foreign Affairs, fairly high up, who was there with him. So one person, it was a very tense meeting with people asking very tough questions. And one of the questions was about the fact that the Institute had just employed a new member whose name escapes me right now, who previously had been the publisher of David Irving. Now David, in Polish, right, David Irving, and I think you would have known from the most recent film, if not from other things, the film Denial that just came out, you know, one of the most prominent Holocaust deniers. And this guy was his publisher. So the guy started to be very defensive and said, well, David Irving published some good things. This was in Polish and then translated into English. I was sitting right behind him, because if he would have seen my face and my horror, Yehuda Bauer was the main person, and he responded so beautifully and so strongly to this statement that there was some, might have been some good things about sort of defending why his work had been published in Poland.
We've got room for one last question, and it's there. Yeah.
Damien, you looked, or noted that today, with selfism, people are looking for meaning within themselves, and then in your work, looking at your family, noted that yesterday, in a sense, people value family life. As you philosophise on those things, are there thoughts that you can bring into the present and into the future, or is the valuing of family gone forever?
Well, it's very hard to change these things. You know, this is the feature of institutions, I think. You know, this is why we should guard them jealously and appreciate their value, because when they're gone, they're very, very hard to replace. It's not something you can just create overnight. Institutions come over a long period of time, and so it's not, you know, you can't just think that if you get rid of them on a whim, you can somehow then recreate them. It's simply not like that. It may be the case that over time, new institutions will be created and new forms of shared value will emerge, and maybe that will be the case. It will take a long time for that to happen. I don't know. I don't want to say, oh, it's complete doom and gloom, but I think Paul Kelly's writing about this is really on the mark, and I think he's right that there has been a change that's come across Australia relatively recently this has sort of surfaced, and I think it has. We're starting to see the very profound change that it brings to the way people live and their expectations of the world. And maybe it's not too late to reassert otherwise, but I'm not sure whether people want to. You know, maybe it will only be when it's too late that people realise that they lost something valuable. Maybe that will be the case.
Damien and Susan, thanks.
There's just one little thing. I don't know whether you know, Susan, but Archbishop Mannix used to go to scripture classes with the Rabbi of Melbourne on Saturday afternoons, which I think pops up your story, Damien, about how it was thrown together. He was out from Ireland, I don't know where the Rabbi was from, but feeling the outcast in one sense, but then much of one sense in another.
Well, a quick response from one or both. Yep. Susan, perhaps.
Yes, there's no doubt in Australia that Catholics and Jews came together, they worked together, really starting from the 1830s when education was still very much Anglican-based, fighting for a denominational approach, which finally comes out in New South Wales in 1848. And there are many important stories of Jews and Catholics coming together, working together. There are some, Bishop Pilcher is the one who springs to mind in terms of the Anglicans, an outstanding man who some say his career was really blighted because of his support both for Jewish refugees and for the creation of Israel for the Zionist movement. So, yes, I would agree with that.
Right, folks, so we're right on time. We've got copies of Susan Rutland's book, Edge of the Diaspora, and copies of Damien Freeman's book, The Aunt's Mirrors. And finally, just to say that it's been an important discussion about the Jewish influence in Australia, an important contribution for a population, as has been pointed out, as so small on a per capita basis. So Jewish settlement in Australia has been discussed very adequately today by both speakers, once from a sense of history, more so, and once from a sense of memoir, more so, but both combining a bit of the other and both talking about similar backgrounds. So we've had a very interesting discussion tonight, and I'm sure both our speakers will be back in the future. But for tonight, thank you and well done.